Close to maintenance every.
Good morning. I'm convening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, Wednesday, February 27th. This is the House Committee on Revenue, but we are very pleased that the Senate Revenue Committee has joined us for this informational meeting. Materials will now be posted and available. So for those of you who might have had the Revenue Committee hearing already up on a web page, you would need to refresh the web page so that materials will now be available to you. Mr. Alanak.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So the usual routine, Mark and Josh are here from the Office of Economic Analysis to provide the March, what we refer to as the March 1 forecast.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committees. For the record, my name is Mark McMullen, Oregon State Economist, joined as always by my colleague Josh Lehner to give, as Chris mentioned, the March revenue and economic and revenue outlook. So we're looking at just 4 months left till the end of the biennium, but there's still a lot of uncertainty in terms of how we're going to end it and the revenue outlook. We're just now getting the first crumbs of information out of the tax filing season. Of course, as a personal income tax dependent state, the April and year-end filings can really move the needle in Oregon. They always do, and they're always tough to forecast. You know, April surprises are pretty commonplace, but this time they're even more considerations than normal. And when we get into the revenue outlook, we'll talk about some of those. A lot of them stemming from the reforms on the federal side that have made some of the recent collections data hard to interpret. So we'll dig into that in quite a bit of detail when we get to the revenue forecast. But first, we'll go ahead and talk a little bit about the economic backdrop. And right now, in terms of the economic forecast for this upcoming biennium, the 1921 biennium, there's really a strong consensus out there, almost a tighter consensus among forecasters than seen in years, in terms of most all forecasters are expecting a pretty significant slowdown as we get into this 2020 period. And there are quite a few headwinds that Josh will outline here in a second that you know are pretty compelling argument in terms of that. But I just wanted to say the way the consensus forecast is right now is it's with this sharp slowdown in growth, it's really neither here nor there. It's not it's not a recession for sure in the outlook, and it's not really a traditional expansion either. And so just to highlight that in terms of this economic outlook as we go into the next biennium, there's risks on both the upside and the downside. We a lot of times we talk about the recessionary risk and what, you know, may precipitate the next downturn, but also keep in mind there is a possibility that we'll continue to grow at stronger rates throughout that biennium. And that's been something that traditionally has been an issue for the Oregon revenue and forecast, is that just as we're at the late stages of an expansion, we get, rather than slowing down, we get a couple of years more of good, strong growth, which can lead to a large kicker at the very end of the expansion, just before things turn south. And so just bearing in mind that I think where we put this forecast is really symmetric in terms of risks on both sides. So to kick off, I'll let Josh talk a little bit about kind of the logic behind the slowdown that we and other forecasters have built into the outlook.
Thanks, Mark. Madam Chair, members of the committees, for the record, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. And what you see in front of you is something we showed you 3 months ago as well, where we're looking at slowing U.S. economic growth. And the next biennium, 1921, is highlighted in yellow just to kind of call that out. And you can see the bottom two lines for U.S. GDP and for U.S. employment overall are really tapering quite quickly over the next couple of years. And it's come smack dab in over the course of the budget budget you guys are working on right now, trying to put some figures together and balance the budget. The income numbers above it are a little better. They're relatively stable. And one way they do that at the U.S. level is we're seeing slowing employment growth, but then we have accelerating wage growth. So that kind of offsets itself and holds wages fairly steady. Here in Oregon, we're unlikely to see a similar pattern because our wage growth is already 3 to 4% at an annual pace for workers across Oregon. The U.S., they're just now accelerated from 2% to 3% over the last year, and forecasters are expecting, the U.S. can get back up to 3.5% or 4%. Well, we don't think we have a lot more acceleration left in the Oregon numbers because we've been so strong for so long. It's possible we could take another step up, but this would be something we haven't seen historically. We're expecting 4% average wage growth in Oregon for the forecast period. That's what we've seen for the last 4 years, and we're not expecting another step up given wages are tied to productivity growth and inflation, and then also overall wages are tied to the size of the labor force. And the demographics and the size of the labor force is really the key component over the medium and long-term forecast being significantly slower. And we'll talk more about retirements and demographics here in a couple of slides. But the economy is starting to slow. It's set to slow. And it's going to be it impacts our economic and revenue forecast for the upcoming biennium. The good news is our forecast is stable, or it's relatively unchanged relative to 3 months ago, both on the economic and revenue side, at least at the top lines. And so while we're expecting slower growth, we've been building this into our forecast for quite some time now. You can see Oregon has slowed from 2015-2016 time period, where we were at peak growth rates. Job growth in Oregon was twice that in a typical state. Today, if you look at the most recent 3 or 6 months of data, Oregon's job growth is matching the U.S. average or in the typical state. The slowdown has been very pronounced. It's been a little bit more pronounced than we had expected in our forecast. But given underlying demographics and population growth, we still expect Oregon to outperform the typical state. But in a mature business expansion, when growth is slowing overall, we're starting to run into some capacity constraints, population growth itself is slowing down, maybe that advantage between Oregon and the U.S. is a little bit smaller over the next few years than it was just a couple years ago when we were really still digging out from the Great Recession and putting all the unemployed Oregonians back to work. Right now, as we talked about on a couple slides ago, we're seeing this pullback or this deceleration in a lot of drivers of economic growth. Federal fiscal policy is fading. The tax cuts have had an impact, but that's fading. The federal spending is starting to slow after the big package was passed a couple of years ago. Business investment starting to wane a little bit. International trade is a risk to the outlook. So a lot of these other potential drivers of growth are at least fading or holding steady at best. And so really the U.S. consumer is going to be the key to the near term right this year and next year. And people are becoming a little bit more concerned about the U.S. consumption, U.S. consumer, because delinquency rates are up just a bit in recent years. And we had a really weak retail sales report to end 2018. The December data was really bad. Just 1 month. It doesn't mean it's a permanent trend or that there's a real cause for concern, but it's a little bit of a cause for concern and has economists worried about the consumer spending, because if consumer spending tapers or falls in 2019, given everything else that's going on, that could be the end of the expansion. But given the labor market gains, wage growth, employment growth continues to be strong in Oregon and across the U.S. it's picking up, the expectations are that the consumption will continue to increase at a healthy rate. The rise in delinquency rates for U.S. consumer loans was really about automobiles. About 3 or 4 years ago, those really picked up. There was a lot of subprime auto lending to people who really couldn't afford it. That seems to have tapered and started to play out. But in the last couple, 12, 18 months, credit card debt and delinquency rates have started to tick up at the U.S. level, and that's kind of across the board too, ages and credit scores and things like that. So maybe the consumer spending has peaked again and we're slowing down, but overall it still seems to be healthy, at least from a historical perspective, even if it has worsened a little bit. So again, this is something a lot of economists and forecasters are concerned about. On the business side, we have both good and bad news. Here you can see delinquency rates on business loans for commercial industrial loans are basically at an all-time low. We had a tick up there a few years ago following the oil crash. A lot of oil and mining related industry companies defaulted on their loans, but that's kind of come back in the loan portfolio overall is performing well. So that's good news for most businesses, both locally and nationally, based on anecdotes we're hearing from the financial industry. But there's one potential cause for concern that U.S. economists are pointing at more, and it's so-called leveraged lending at the U.S. level. These are basically corporations or companies that already have a lot of debt, and they're loading up on more debt to take out, you know, mergers and acquisitions and buyouts and things like that. And so this is growing. It looks okay today because asset values and business valuations are really high. Debt is really high as a share of GDP, but so are valuations. Well, when the economy starts to turn, we know asset valuations and business valuations will plummet, as they always do during a downturn, but the debt does not, right? And so there's the risk moving forward that we're a certain segment of the economy is becoming over-leveraged on corporate debt, and that could be a downturn. Now, this isn't as large as the mortgage market was 10, 15 years ago. It's confined to a relatively small segment as of today, but it is another risk when it comes to the U.S. economic outlook. And, of course, as the U.S. goes, so goes Oregon. We've never missed a U.S. recession or a U.S. expansion. In terms of the slower job growth, maybe potentially within the last 6 months and over our forecast horizon, we're really talking about net job gains, right? You know, the biggest issue with net job gains today is demographics and retirements, right? As the baby boomer cohort continues to enter into their traditional retirement years, you replace a retiree with a new worker, that represents zero job growth, right? You have to add two employees to replace the one to see positive job growth when it comes to how we typically measure the labor market. So there's going to be a ton of generational churn underneath the surface of the labor market. There already is, but expected to be even larger in the next decade as the baby boomers push into their mid-60s and into their early 70s. And even though we're seeing older Oregonians, in a relative sense, you know, 60-year-old Oregonians are working to a larger degree than they ever have in their history. A share of 60-year-old Oregonians who are employed today is the highest on record going back 150 years. And 65-year-olds are getting close, but in this number of 70-year-olds that are working is also creeping back up to levels we haven't seen since the Great Society and War on Poverty began 50 or 60 years ago. We know some of this is good news, or at least neutral news, in the sense that people are able to work longer physically, better health. Desk jobs are a lot easier to do than manual labor, as we age. But some of it's also for bad reasons, financial security. Different estimates come out, but maybe half of all retirees today do not have enough financial security to last their retirement. And so people are having to work longer due to inadequate savings and investment opportunities. And if we look at this locally, we see a wide variation in terms of demographics and potential labor force gains. And I'll turn it over to Mark.
Yeah, so this chart, we're looking at what we call the natural rate of population increase. So the number of births in a county less the number of deaths in a county. So when this becomes negative, that means, or goes to zero, well, that means we won't see any population growth in the absence of net migration, people bringing folks in from elsewhere. And that's rapidly happening across the state. The Oregon average before we get to 2030 is likely going to get to the point where the natural rate of population increase is zero. We've seen birth rates flatten over time in most recent years, and surprisingly so, as the millennial population cohort are delaying, if not more, in terms of their childbearing. And so we're seeing very little of that. And so, again, in the absence of any natural rate of increase, we become more and more dependent on our comparative advantage and migration. But the story really does differ across the state in terms of, you see here, some of these that still have significantly positive rates of natural increase, Morrow, Washington, Marion, Umatilla, the like. A lot of these have one characteristic in common, and that is the presence of a lot of Hispanic households that still have birth rates that are higher than the population as a whole. And so this, well, you know, going forward in terms of the labor dynamics as well. But really the story is pretty positive for now across the spectrum, particularly in terms of this migration that is so important to Oregon. The last few years have seen more broad-based population gains in Oregon than we've ever seen before. In the last couple, 3 years, typically either zero or one county are the only ones who aren't adding population. If we look over the last 5 years, only Grant County has lost population. They lost, and that's only a total of 35 folks in the county. And so this is really more broad-based, you know, than we've ever seen, both in our urban areas and our rural areas, and it's particularly encouraging. And one last thing that is a little bit encouraging as well is when we look at some of these counties at the bottom of the chart, where we're already seeing negative natural rates of population growth, that the outlook for these counties is not as negative as the recent performance that we're seeing here. Why? Because they're ahead of the curve in terms of this aging population. I don't want to say rapidly aging, because we all age chronologically at the same rate, at least, not physically. I and other people age a little bit quicker physically, but going back to Josh's retirement chart, in a lot of these coastal communities and our rural communities out east, they've already taken a lot of this medicine. They've already seen a lot of their population retire and drop out of the workforce. And these aren't just, you know, any workers. They're workers that are highly productive and have a lifetime of experience. And so this does put downward pressure on the labor market growth. But again, for a lot of these coastal and eastern counties, they're well along the way toward aging out this baby boom population cohort. And so going forward, we'll face less of a headwind than they have in recent years, and what some of the other counties that we're seeing in Oregon will. So moving on to the revenue outlook, despite the fact that the biennium is almost over, there is quite a bit of uncertainty out there because we still have one more tax season to go. And of course, the personal income tax, we're so highly dependent upon it here. And so far, we don't have a lot of information yet. The first thing that happens in the tax season is we start putting out refunds. And this chart shows this cumulative path over time in the last 6 years of how those refunds have totaled over time as we go through the filing season. And the first thing you note is we've just barely started. And so again, we don't have a whole lot of information. And the last couple, 3 years, due to hiccups at the federal level and changes in their policy, we've seen this refund season start later and later. And so right now, in the 2019, the darkest red line there, we're just barely reaching about 200 million, but we have reached the point where the refunds now, we're seeing them go out in the tens of millions of dollars per day. So we will start to get more information, and then eventually in April and May, we start to get the folks that owe taxes and the payments coming in. And so when we get back together here on May 15th for the most important forecast of the cycle, when we set the bar for the balanced budget requirements and the kicker law and the like, we'll hopefully know a little bit more about the filing season. But again, this year there's always a lot of moving parts, but this year there are a whole lot of things that are adding uncertainty to that. One issue we're looking at is withholding out of personal income taxes. So the amount that's taken out of your paycheck over time and retirement checks and pensions and the like. And traditionally, this has moved very much in lockstep with our other measures of wages that come out of the Employment Department and the Payroll Survey, and also coming out of the National Income Accounts. And over the history, these have really, our Oregon tax withholding has really moved closely and grown very closely with these economic measures of wages that we have. Outside of a few limited periods when, say, some of our big employers will pay a big bonus check, and we'll see that in the data where withholding will deviate from the wages, or when we change the withholding tables and the like, we can see temporary divergence in the growth rates, but never like we've seen over the last 3 years now, where consistently Oregon's withholding has been stronger than our underlying economic measures of wages that we use to drive them in the model. So there are a couple things that could be behind this. For one, there is an increasing share of pension income in these wages, and although we have limited time series on this, they have been growing quite a bit faster than the work-related or labor-related wages, so that could explain some of this. And there are also changes at the federal level in terms of both tax liability, which it can impact liability here indirectly through the federal subtraction, and the withholding at the federal level as we change the tables, and we've created a new Oregon specific W-4 here and the like, which will filter through to a certain extent into higher withholding here, but not a whole lot of big numbers. So there's still the concern that, well, what happens if taxpayers have withheld more than they expected to or wanted to? Well, then at the end of the year, when we get to this April payment, there'll be fewer dollars coming in terms of payments, or more dollars going out in terms of refunds, if taxpayers have in some sense overpaid for the past year. So, excuse me, in addition to withholding, though, even though we've had the strong withholding up until just the last couple of months, January and February have come off, stepping back and looking at overall personal income taxes is a little bit scary right now. If you look at, this is a three-month average, so for the past quarter in Oregon's personal income tax collections, we've seen slower growth, the slowest growth on record, even slower than at the peak of our Great Recession. And this can really be, you can really isolate the cause of this, and it's coming from year-end estimated tax payments. In December and January, taxpayers make their last quarterly estimated payment in Oregon and in other income tax states, and we saw a precipitous drop in that this year. It's half the size it was last year. And it's not just in Oregon, it's across the U.S. as a whole, where all income tax states have seen this real drop. But while everyone's seeing it, there isn't necessarily a consensus in terms of what it means for April returns. In terms of our counterparts in other states, they seem to be split into two camps. Half of the folks say, oh, well, the estimated payments are so low, that means people will owe more in April and have to pay more. The other half say, this is, they're predicting their April returns. They're really, with that last quarterly payment, they're taking stock of how their year went and saying, oh, well, maybe I've been overpaying or underpaying, and so they're getting out in front of this April payment by, you know, and so that would suggest that low estimates at the year end 2018 would mean low payments in April of 2019. Which is the camp that we are in. From our advisory groups, that we talk to accountants and tax lawyers, and they have pointed out in the past that that's exactly what they do, that this last quarter estimated payment is very predictive of what they're looking at in terms of their expected liability in April. And in the past, that's worked pretty darn well. Up until the last 2 years, this has been very helpful to our April outlook, to avoid our April surprises, insofar as the size of these December and January last quarterly estimated payment matches very well with all the kinds of things that move the April needle, in particular all the non-wage kind of investment incomes, the capital gains and business income, rental income, dividends, interest, and the like. And so that's the stuff that we use to really drive our April payment forecast. Unlike wages that are constant across the year, this is the stuff that can be cashed for tax purposes all at once. And for the past decade or so, this has been a really tight relationship, where this December or January estimated payment is almost exactly 2% of the overall non-wage income. And this has been very helpful up until 2017. And in 2017, in anticipation of the federal tax law changes, we saw massive payments at the end of last year, or at the end of 2017, in December and in January of 2018. And a lot of this may have been mistaken insofar as, you know, in Oregon, a lot of the prepayments for property taxes or prepayments for state and local taxes that people were advising taxpayers to do to get out in front of some of the restrictions on deductibility that came as part of the federal tax law. This we saw a huge surge again in these payments. Well, this year we had exactly the opposite, where now you see we only saw $337 million in December, January estimated payments, which is as low as they've been since we first started coming out of the Great Recession.
Jeez.
And so another way to look at this is the old relationship we were depending upon are the blue line, or the blue dots. 2017, 2016 used to be a really tight relationship, but now we've diverged quite a bit. But luckily, in terms of the outlook, we don't depend entirely on this indicator sort of model. We have the underlying econometric models, too, where each of these portions of non-withheld income, capital gains, Schedule E, and the like, are built up using our economic outlook. So we look at stock markets and house prices that drive our capital gain outlook. We look at, you know, proprietor's income and things from our national income accounts that drive our business income and the like. And so those models would suggest that 2018, in terms of that the April payments, will not be a great year, but not a terrible one either. And so that's what we've built into the baseline. But there is quite a bit of uncertainty here just because this drop is so precipitous and there isn't a clear reason why. A lot of behavioral assumptions, but nothing that we have a strong consensus on. So always, one of the trickiest parts of April is trying to get a hold of these non-wage forms of income, particularly capital gains. Capital gains can be earned in the market over a period of years, but they get cashed for tax purposes all at once, and it's not necessarily correlated with when the gains were accrued. And so how that matters for this round is we saw just before December 31st in 2018, we saw a real sharp drop in equity prices, which are the primary driver of our taxable capital gains. And so what does that mean for this April? Well, it's uncertain because in the past, a lot of times when we've had sell-offs in the stock market, capital gains or taxable capital gains don't drop right away. In fact, sometimes they would stay surprisingly strong for a year or so. Because what's happened in the last couple of rounds is when the market takes a downturn, investors start pulling out their assets, selling them off, and they are taking in profits that from long ago. These are long-held assets. And so even though the price is dropping today, maybe when they bought it 10 years ago, there's still profit made, and then so therefore there are these taxable events. And so we saw that in the last two big swings, but since those last two big swings, the tech boom and bust and the housing boom and bust, we've seen the holding periods for stocks and assets have shortened. And so some folks are suggesting, well, maybe after these two big purges, there isn't the same kind of stock of unrealized gains out there to be cashed in all at once or potentially at the end of last year. And so one way of looking at this is looking at Federal Reserve data from the Survey of Consumer Finance and to take a look at what is this stock of unrealized capital gains. Well, it's quite a bit bigger than the ones that are actually realized. You see here we're now up over $8 billion in terms of the current year's capital realizations, but the unrealized gains are much larger, probably in the $300 to $400 billion range. But depending on our choice of base year and other assumptions, most the data does point to the fact that I think we have built up a significant store of these realized gains, so that this boom bust cycle is still a possibility. But we don't have a particularly pronounced one in the outlook, and part of that has to do with the composition of these unrealized gains. Back in the early 2000s, the unrealized capital gains in Oregon were disproportionately tilted towards equities and stock market gains. In the Great Recession, it was disproportionately tilted towards housing market gains. And this time, it's different altogether. What we're seeing in terms of an unusually large share of these unrealized gains this time around is business equity. And so folks that have their own businesses and have seen the value of that business increase. Well, fundamentally, businesses are less liquid than our stocks and housing. And so it's harder to sell your business on a moment's notice at the end of the tax year in 2018 as it would be the more liquid assets, particularly the equities. And so given that, we do still have some of this boom-bust type pattern in the outlook, but not nearly as pronounced as the last two rounds. So those are all the uncertainties going into April, and again, we'll have a much more complete picture when we come back for the final forecast that goes into the close of session in May 15th. But for this current forecast, the one thing that's really moving the needle for today has been our corporate collections in Oregon, where corporate tax collections are certainly booming. Here you see we're now at an annual running rate of $900 million a year, which is 50% more than our previous peak level or where we were just a year or two ago. And so this is very dramatic, and we didn't have a whole lot of growth built into the underlying outlook, so a lot of this is unexpected revenue. Now, part of it is certainly temporary. We know somewhere around $100 million of this has to do with the repatriation of foreign earnings that was required with the federal tax law. And so in Oregon, this will be about $100 million. We'll know more a couple years from now. The Department of Revenue is going to assess how much came in as from the repatriation, and then that will be deposited into a fund to cover some of the unfunded PERS liability for school districts. Given that it's a one-time uncertain revenue source, the legislature, in their wisdom, decided to go ahead and say, okay, whatever this is, we'll just go ahead and put it aside rather than count on it for the budgeting purposes. But that still leaves quite a bit of an increase here. And so what we have to do is parse out how much of it is fundamental and potentially permanent versus how much is temporary. And some of it clearly is temporary. Again, when we talk to accountants, they say, well, with all this uncertainty in terms of the changes in corporate tax law, some of us are playing it safe. And we're making big payments today just to make sure that we're not subject to penalties or anything later down the line. And so some of this may evaporate, but some of it might stay. Another thing that the federal tax law did or intended to do at the corporate level, and particularly for the C corporations that Oregon depends on with its current system, was to broaden the base of corporate taxation, take things like some globally low taxed income and try to bring that back for assessment here and the like. But at the same time, lowering drastically the federal corporate tax rate. So you gave them a lot of rate relief, but increased the base. Well, Oregon, has its own corporate tax rate. So any increases in this corporate base through the various provisions may, pass through to Oregon. And so we do believe that some of this is occurring, that some of the base has become broader, and as a result, we've increased the outlook for corporate taxes throughout the forecast, and in particular for this current biennium where we see this huge spike has already happened, that really drives a upward revision today. So sorry about all the numbers in the revenue forecast summary sheet here. It's difficult to try to put both the current biennium and the next biennium, which the legislature has now turned its attention to, in one sheet. But the upshot here is you see, relative to 3 months ago, the big difference is corporate income taxes, where we've increased the outlook by $123 million, largely because of tracking. And personal income taxes, with the withholdings being so strong, have been tracking a little bit high as well, even after this step back in estimated payments. So they've been revised a little bit up in the near term as well. And other revenues have been revised downward. That's being driven by criminal fines and assessments, and as we refine our estimates, particularly of some of the traffic cameras, and the revenue that we're getting out of that has been revised downward. But all told, driven by this corporate income tax, we're looking at $144 million of additional revenue in the current biennium. Now, going forward into the future biennia, that increase doesn't persist, as we see some declines in personal income taxes. The personal income tax forecast has been revised down over the next couple of biennia. That is a directly feeding through from our economic outlook. In particular, our U.S. forecast vendors revised down their forecast for income this last 3 months, and mostly in response to what we saw at the end of the year in terms of the equity prices and the like. And so that feeds directly through. When we take a third of a percent away from the income forecast, that directly feeds into less personal income taxes, but that's offset to a certain degree by the corporate income taxes expecting to hold some of these gains permanently as we go forward. So all told, the bottom right-hand corner there is the two biennia together. Taken together, we would have $61.5 million in additional available resources for 1921 if the 1719 ending balance is fully passed forward. So that's good news. But one thing that we do have here in 1719 is a smallish increase in non-corporate taxes, which means our personal income tax kicker has increased somewhat. So from last time we were at $724 million, now we're at $748 million for the personal income tax kicker that's expected to be paid out in 2019-2021. The corporate income tax kicker was repealed, but we continue to estimate it, and any of the unforeseen kicker revenue is slated to go to additional spending for K-12. And with this huge run-up in corporate taxes, that has gotten much larger as well. So the current corporate kicker amount is $353 million. Now, those are big numbers. They're not particularly large, you know, over time. In terms of our history, here's the history of our office's kicker credit or refund on the personal tax side, where typically it runs somewhere in, you know, the mean or median of this is somewhere around where we are now at 8% of single year tax liability. The kicker threshold is, of course, 2% of non-corporate general fund revenues, which is a two-year and much broader concept than it's paid out through a one-year credit on the income taxes. And so these numbers are bigger than 2%. But right today in the current biennium, we're somewhere right in the middle of our historical experience. The two times we've labeled sweet spot in 91-93 and 11-13 are the only times we've been able to forecast right in between this close of session forecast and the 2% threshold, so that additional revenue we get to keep for budgeting purposes. So twice we've been right in that 0 to 2% window. One time in 89-91, the legislature suspended the kicker with a two-thirds vote. The legislature can change our estimate at the close of session and thereby suspend a kicker, and that was done during the recession of the early 1990s. But so while in dollar terms, obviously, so, you know, $748 million is a big number, and, you know, in terms of the history of the kicker, we're somewhere in the middle.
But one, of course, characteristic of the kicker is that it goes out in the same, in proportionately to the way personal income taxes are paid in Oregon, which, although is not progressive, so to speak, it is somewhat more so than most states. It definitely means more money for higher income folks. Here we see for a median income filer, somewhere around $35,000 or $36,000 a year, the typical kicker credit would be $180. So unlike what was done several years ago, the kicker now is paid out as part of the traditional tax filing process. It doesn't come as a check around Christmas time as it had in the past. And so as a result, this does affect the contours of the revenue forecast. So you can see here that our expectations for revenue growth in 1921 are very low relative to, you know, historical periods of expansion, and that's the direct effect of the kicker going out through the tax process, either in terms of lower payments for folks that owe taxes at the end of the year, or bigger refunds for those who are owed money. And then as that kicker is not expected in the 21-23 biennium, those growth rates appear artificially high. But if without that kicker credit going out, you would see a pattern much like Josh showed in terms of the income and the employment outlook, where the growth rates in state revenue would decline, but in a smooth manner toward ending up at somewhere around 9 or 10% per biennium, which is slow relative to our historic experience for an expansion. But again, the weight of the demographic change in particular is especially hard on state government revenues, even more so than it is on the labor market indicators. So finally, to finish up, I've been finishing with this for the last few rounds because it is the happy good news story, is that whenever we do see a downturn come, and it, we certainly will sometime in the next couple of biennia, we, for the first time in Oregon, have significant reserve funds squirreled away, which we've never really had before, to help offset the downturn in our volatile revenue streams. Here, if we include ending balances with our Education Stability Fund and our Rainy Day Fund, we expect to end the current biennium at north of $2.5 billion, which is 12% of our two-year budget, which is, again, very significant, something we've never had before. Not enough to ease the entire pain of a recession, but it certainly will go a long way toward that end. So with that, I'd like to thank you all for having us, and would be happy to entertain any questions if you guys have them.
Thank you very much for the presentation. And as always, it was excellent information, and I certainly enjoy listening to an economist who includes in his vocabulary a descriptor like small-ish. Representative Finley.
Thank you, Chair. So I have a question. I believe I know the answer, but I'm going to ask you anyway. As you look at the future in 1921, are you looking at potential legislation that will impact the economies of Oregon, such as the cap and trade bill? Because in my district, I've heard that all the industry will more than likely move to Idaho or Nevada, which would have a devastating impact on our economy. And I'm just wondering, are you looking at that and the impacts of those that legislation may have?
Vice Chair Findley, Chair Nathanson. Luckily, that's not part of our dictate. Our forecast by construction is a current law forecast. So no matter how likely a policy is to be enacted, we don't put words in the legislature's mouth. And so until the bill is signed by the governor, it is not in the forecast. And so what does that mean? That means it is Chris Alanak and LRO's problem for now to tell us what the impact of those potential policies are. And then the day after it's passed, then we take ownership of those estimates. And as we start to get data and have historical experience, we adjust those original impact estimates.
Thank you.
Senator Tate.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Thank you for the presentation. I always enjoy this. So I guess I have a two-part question. One, I assume you must have some data that your counterparts in other states that all of you collect, right? And it goes into some sort of national report. Correct? Is there some sort of nationwide LRO, I mean, like the economists such as yourself collect information about?
That's right. Senator Taylor, Chair Nathanson, yes, we have trade groups, as it were, one of which is particularly useful in the April filing season, and that's the Federation of Tax Administrators, FTA. And so what here in a couple of weeks, we have an annual call with our counterparts in other states who say, well, how is this filing season going with you? How is it tracking? And we're already having our inbox filled up with folks asking questions. What's going on with the estimated payments? What's going on with corporate taxes and the like in your state? And so we do have dialogue with other states. That's very useful for us because for our modeling purposes, there's almost nothing that's more valuable than knowing what is a phenomenon that's unique to Oregon versus a phenomenon that's beyond us and is something that's going on in other states as well.
Follow up? Thank you, Chair Nathanson. So I don't know if this is tracked or not, but in other states, how accurate are state economists' estimates of revenue for the quarter?
Senator Taylor, I'd like to think we get the state of the art around here for sure.
I do. I feel very fortunate. I'm just curious about the other states, how they perform.
That said, there are a lot of factors that play in. One thing is some states, are only a one-year budget period rather than a biennial budget period. So obviously the further you look out, the more difficult it is. Some states don't update as frequently as we do quarterly. And the more we update, better that is as well. And of course, the mix of the volatility in your economy and your revenue instruments you use play a part as well. Here in Oregon, not only do we have a volatile underlying economy, we have a very volatile mix of revenue instruments leaning on corporate and personal income taxes, which swing around violently from year to year compared with some other state tax instruments, in particular general sales taxes. So we tease our counterparts in sales tax states and tell them that, you know, when they're proud of their forecast, we say, well, you guys pitch underhand because it's much, much easier.
Follow up? Yes. I'm just curious. I appreciate that. And I understand it's a nuanced situation and we're on the record here. But are other states required or are they tracking or is there any other state where a state economist has said, you need to make this projection, this estimate, and then a legislature is going to say whether or not you are accurate?
Senator Taylor, there is no, the kicker law is very unique. And there is no other state that has one that works in the same way as do we.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
For the presentation. There's no other business that I see. No one asking to speak. Thank you. We are adjourned.